Is this all of us? Here we are. Good morning. Hi, everyone. I'm Darren. Good to be back together. You guys feeling good? First Sunday of December? You got your Christmas gifts all sorted? I think there's two kinds of people in this world. Planners and the people married to them. Right? So if you've... Maybe by accident. They don't even know why they're married to them. Somebody had an idea. No. So if you've already got your Christmas gifts sorted, you might be a planner. If you already know what's on your summer holiday reading list for next year, you might be a planner. Some of you are ashamed right now. If you already know what songs and readings you want at your memorial service when you die, you might be a planner. If, like me, you were a four-year-old asking what's for lunch before you'd finished breakfast, you might be a planner. See, today we are looking at the third chapter of Ruth. It's a great story. It's an amazing story about how God accomplishes his extraordinary purposes through the actions of everyday, ordinary, faithful people. And to say it another way, it's really the story of how God uses people's plans, whether they're successful or not, to accomplish his even greater plans. Isn't that amazing? So we're going to look at Ruth chapter 3. It's page 257 in the books, in the Bibles in front of you. And really, we've seen God accomplishing his plans all along through this whole story. So in chapter 1, what did we see? We saw Naomi, who ends up being, we met two different characters. The main characters, we meet Naomi, who ends up being a widow who returns to her hometown. After 10 years in a foreign land, she's without children. She's lost her husband and her children to death. And her daughter-in-law, Ruth, we meet her in chapter 1, who's lost her husband, Naomi's son, and she finds herself as a childless, husbandless refugee back in Bethlehem. And as you know, I'm pretty sure that neither one of them had this in mind when they set out on the journey, that this would be the way it ended up. This was not how they had it planned. And yet, by the end of chapter 1, I mean, we even see Naomi says, you know, don't even call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara, which means bitter. The Lord has left me bitter. I'm empty. And we also see Ruth in chapter 1 make a commitment and begin to develop a plan to commit for the rest of her life to the care and concern of Naomi, her mother-in-law, no matter what. So that's chapter 1. In chapter 2, we see Ruth carrying out this plan to care for Naomi by providing food. And we meet another main character, Boaz, who's a man of valor. He's a wealthy landowner, and he takes it upon himself to bring protection and provision to these people who are close family members and relatives of Naomi's. And he works out a plan to make sure that Ruth can carry home as much food as possible to provide for them after a season of famine. And he arranges for her to be protected. So really, throughout this whole story, we see the fingerprints of God moving behind the scenes to enable these faithful people to show loving kindness to each other and also to carry out an even bigger plan of God's, which we are just beginning to get a glimpse of by the end of chapter 2. And so now we look at chapter 3. So let's do this together now, and let's look together at the words of chapter 3. And rather than read all the way through as we have in the last couple of weeks, what I'd like to do is look at each section just piece by piece as we walk through it together. So that's how we're going to read through it together today. And that's partly because the writing in this chapter is just so exquisite. I mean, it's just beautiful. And there's a couple of surprises along the way, and I don't want to give them away by reading ahead. So just walk with me now through this third chapter of Ruth. Just so you know, when chapter 2 ends, we're sort of fast-forwarding to the end of the harvest season. There's probably several weeks that have gone by, maybe up to 7 weeks. And so one day, Naomi, verse 1, Ruth's mother-in-law, she says to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for." Now, if you think about this, they have been hungry for so long, and she's finally been able to eat a number of meals in a row. And as you can imagine, there's a certain point when you cease to be hungry anymore, when you're actually able to think ahead beyond just meal to meal, day by day. So she's able to think ahead, and she's able to actually think beyond just herself, isn't she? She's thinking about Ruth's well-being. And she says, "I've got to find a home, maybe rest would be another translation, where you would be well provided for. So here's the plan, verse 2. Boaz, with those the women whom you've worked, he's a close relative of ours. And tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Now, hands up if you've ever winnowed barley on the threshing floor. That is a good phrase, right? Basically, we've completed the harvest. We've got mountains of this stuff ready to go. And what they do is the threshing floor is kind of an open air space, kind of just on the outskirts of the town. And it's where the breezes can kind of flow into this open air space, kind of a big room. But the breezes can blow through. So what you do is you kind of lift on a big pitchfork. You lift the barley up into the air, and you let the wind kind of blow away the chaff. And then you get your kind of your barley. And you kind of stack it up high in a big pile. And this is Boaz is going to work the night shift, and Naomi knows it. And she says, I think he's going to be there, he's going to be doing this. And this is kind of a time of celebration. I mean, it's the end of harvest. So it's really a time when it's, you know, there's a lot of partying and celebration. And she knows this. So she says, she's got a plan. And the plan is, we need to get you a husband. Look at what happens. Number 3, wash and perfume yourself. Put on your best clothes. And then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. You know, we don't want to cause a scene. We don't want to cause him shame or embarrassment by having you show up smelling good, looking good at this place where there's a lot of partying and celebration in case people get the wrong idea about this. We don't want to put him on the spot and cause him shame in case, you know, a public act would force him into something he's not ready for. So let's just do it quietly. Don't let him know you're there. In fact, do it later after it gets dark. Look at what she says. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying, okay? It's going to get dark, Ruth, so pay attention to where Boaz ends up or you're going to end up going to the wrong guy, okay? So make a note to yourself of where he ends up laying down. And then, this is just one of the most unusual spots in the whole story, go and uncover his feet and lie down. And he will tell you what to do. The plan is, let's get you a husband. But let's do it privately. Let's do it carefully so we don't shame the guy in front of others. Now, Ruth's response is, it's kind of amazing. I will do whatever you say. She answers. And so she went down to the threshing floor, and she did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. This is verse 6. Well, she does everything that she was told, and we're about to see that, but she does something a little bit different at the end. She kind of goes off script, and we'll get to that in just a moment. So when Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. He's in a solitary place. He's alone. I kind of imagine the dragon in Lord of the Rings kind of sleeping on top of his pile, as a pile of gold. You know, it's kind of that image. And Ruth approaches quietly. Now listen, because this is a significant part of this text. Cover of night. She's tiptoeing quietly. I imagine suddenly the lights go down. We're no longer in the sunny fields of Bethlehem in chapter 2. We're in a dark, secluded place. I think if this were a play, there'd be no lighting on the stage, save for perhaps maybe just a tiny little spotlight. If it were a movie, it might be one of those awkward scenes where there's just nothing on screen but darkness, and you really only get dialogue. And you say, where are you getting this? Well, actually, look, at verse 8, in the middle of the night, that's kind of a signifier that it's really dark and it's quiet. And we lose the proper names of who's who, right? We don't even get Boaz and Ruth, we get the man and the woman. So we just hear a man's voice and a woman's voice. Now, why is the writer doing this? I think it's very tempting in this situation to assume all kinds of suggestive things are going on under the cover of darkness. But we don't want to get distracted by that, because in reality, it's really about what the people are saying to each other. So we get no visual clues under the cover of darkness besides a man's voice and a woman's voice. It's about the dialogue, because what they say to each other is going to be hugely significant. So she uncovers his feet, and she lies down. And in the middle of the night, something startles the man. And he turns, and there's a woman lying at his feet. And here's the dialogue. Just imagine a pitch-dark screen, and back and forth, verse 9. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a family guardian." Now, the translation here could actually say, "Spread your wings over me." We talked about that last week. Boaz said it to Ruth, may the Lord bless you as you have come under the shelter and provision of his wings. And here it is, spread the corner of your garment over me, since you're a family guardian. Later on, there's some really beautiful poetry in Ezekiel that sort of refers to what's happening here. Ezekiel 16:18 says the same phrase, cover me with your garment. Later I passed by, is the scripture here in Ezekiel. When I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. This is God speaking to his people. I covered your nakedness. I spread the corner of my garment over you, and I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. I think what's happening here is Ruth actually going beyond the instructions of Naomi. Naomi says, we need to get you a husband. Ruth is thinking, I'm actually going to go further than that. I'm not going to wait for him to tell me what to do. I'm going to take initiative, offer a marriage proposal, but extend it even further and say, we need to get some land redeemed for Naomi, my mother-in-law. See, she says both. It's spread the corner of your garment over me, but also you're a family guardian. Another translation of that would be you're a kinsman redeemer. Now, what's she doing there? She's saying, for the sake of my mother-in-law, I want to claim you as the closest relative to be able to buy back land, hand in the voucher for land that would have been lost under her name during the years that we were away in Moab. Okay, there's a lot going on here, which is why I think we get all the visual distractions out of the way and we listen in the dark to these two people talking. Spread the corner of your garment over me, but also help my mother-in-law redeem this land. You're our family guardian. This is your legal obligation, she says. So it's both. She's got a plan. And this is the beautiful thing about Hesed, right? We talked about loving kindness last week. The beautiful thing is Naomi's thinking about Ruth. She needs a husband. She needs a future. And Ruth's actually thinking about Naomi. You know what? My mother-in-law needs an inheritance. Sure, she needs offspring to carry on the family line, but she needs redemption of this land that wouldn't have been part of her family anymore, because she's come back without her husband. And Boaz picks up on it immediately. Look at verse 10. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replies. This kindness is greater than that which you've shown earlier. What does he mean by that? The kindness, which kindness are we talking about? Well, first of all, the translation of that word is what we talked about last week, Hesed. This loving kindness, this enduring commitment that you're showing to Naomi is even better than what happened last chapter when you came and pushed your way into the fields to say, I need to get as much food as I can for our family. This kindness is even greater than what you've showed earlier. You know, you could have married younger men. He says in the same verse 10, you could have married younger men. You could have married for love, which would be marrying a poor guy. Or you could have married for wealth, which would have been marrying a wealthy guy. But you didn't. You didn't leave Naomi, your mother-in-law. You've stayed faithful to her. And now here you are, taking this step of obedience and reaching out in great trust and loving kindness. So don't be afraid, he says in verse 11, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that I ask, all that you ask. Now, why does he say this? Look at this. This is just a remarkable phrase. All the people of my town, they already know that you are a woman of noble character. A woman of noble character. This phrase is actually the phrase that's used of Boaz in chapter 1. The man of good standing. Did you see that? The translation here is a man of valor. But he's saying you're a woman of valor and everybody already knows it. This perfume that he's smelling that she put on earlier in this little story kind of represents the perfume of a good reputation. The whole town already knows that you're a woman of strength, that you're a woman of integrity, of loving kindness, of commitment. Do you know where else we get this? It's the one place that this phrase, woman of valor, is used in the Old Testament about a specific person. The other description is in Proverbs 31, the description of a noble wife, a woman of great character. Pretty amazing stuff that he honors. So guys, If you want to bless your wife this week, if you want to bless a woman in your life who has noble character, you just call her Eshet Chayil, right? Eshet Chayil, the woman of valor. That's the Hebrew phrase of that. If she says, what in the world are you talking about? Just tell her about this. He says, you are a woman of noble character. And Boaz himself, knowing that she chose to marry out of family loyalty, not for money, not for love, could have been a younger guy, and here he is, older. He decides, you know, this is actually an opportunity for me to show chesed as well, integrity, fidelity, faithfulness, and commitment. So rather than take matters into his own hands and just go for the plan as it is, he actually says, you know what, there's another person that needs to step into this legal proceeding first. Look at verse 12. Although it's true that I'm a family guardian, there's another who's more closely related than I. He wants to control the outcome, but instead he releases that and says, actually, the plan here is, legally speaking, I'm more like a cousin than a brother. There's a closer relative that needs to take care of this land transaction before any of this can happen. So he encourages her, stay here for the night, verse 13. And in the morning, if this closer relative wants to do his duty for you as the family guardian, then good. Let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. So lie here until the morning. Now, I think the phrasing of this particular text just suggests nothing suggestive is going on here. Stay here for the morning means I want to protect your reputation. If you leave now and walk back home in the middle of the night, people are going to raise all kinds of questions. Stay here. Now, it says in verse 14, so she lay at his feet until morning. I'm guessing neither one of them slept very well. There's a lot of tension and kind of what happens next in this moment. I mean, I just picture her sort of staying there and trying to get any kind of sleep that you can, and yet wondering what happens next. But he gets up. She gets up before anyone could be recognized. This is verse 14. And he says to her, no one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor. Again, trying to protect her reputation. Then he also says, hey, bring me the shawl that you're wearing and hold it out. And when she did so, he pours in 6 measures of barley and put it on her, and then he goes back into town. So even in this moment of kind of awkward, what happens next, Boaz acts as a channel of God's provision for Naomi, the family. And he also protects Ruth's reputation. She doesn't go home empty-handed. She goes home with something on her back, kind of demonstrating to the people that might ask questions what she was doing out that night and that morning. So you look back at the scene and you kind of picture Naomi pacing, just waiting for Ruth to get back, right? Look at verse 16. When Ruth comes in to her mother-in-law, Naomi asks, well, how did it go? What happened last night? How did it go, my daughter? Still making that family connection, calling her my daughter, even though something might have happened during the evening that would have produced a different alternative outcome, a husband perhaps, for Ruth. How did it go, my daughter? And so Ruth tells her everything that Boaz had done for her. And she adds, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Now, this is really interesting because here we see the final words of Ruth for the whole remainder of the book. She's talked about in chapter 4, but these are her final words. In essence, she's fulfilled at least part of the commitment she makes to Ruth or to Naomi back in the first chapter. She has seen all the way through a faithfulness to her mother-in-law, a chesed, loving kindness that has ensured that she was well cared for. She's not only provided food in chapter 2, but now the potential provision of land through this family guardian, this redeemer interactions here in this story. So she says, you know, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, and he said, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. I have a question for us. Who is the hero of this story so far? I mean, I think a lot of us want it to be Boaz, right? The wealthy guy, who can help out the refugees and care for the widow and the orphan, the guy who's got the provision and the connections and the covering. But we're not reading the third chapter of Boaz, are we? We're reading the third chapter of Ruth, and I think Boaz knows that she, the woman of valor, is the hero of this story. Why? Because of her commitment to loving kindness all the way through. In chapter 1, she pauses on the road and says, Naomi, I'm with you all the way to death. In chapter 2, she says, I'm going to go get us food, even at great risk of myself. I'm going to provide for us. And in chapter 3, she submits to Naomi's plan, and she has a little plan of her own. I'm not just going to get married. I'm going to make sure that we get our land and inheritance back for Naomi's sake. That is a hero. That is a woman of strength and valor and initiative. You know, Jesus, much later in the story, teaches that the greatest person in the kingdom is the one who serves with this kind of self-sacrificing love and commitment. He says, if you want to be great in my kingdom, serve everyone. In fact, he teaches his disciples in Mark chapter 8, whoever wants to be my disciple must carry their cross and deny themselves to follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever wants to lose their life, or whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. That's the kind of servanthood that Jesus taught his followers. And it's not just something he taught, it's something that he lived out all the way to the point of death on the cross. This loving kindness that endured was the plan of God all along. So I think what we have here in Ruth chapter 3 is kind of a pre-enactment of the gospel. It's three people who don't even know Jesus yet living out gospel sacrificial loving kindness. Do you see it? Naomi, really, who gives away her only true promise of comfort and care and protection in the future by saying, actually, it's about Ruth, not about me. So she sends Ruth off to get a husband, not knowing what will happen to herself. And it's Ruth being more concerned about Naomi's longevity than her own. She wants inheritance for her mother-in-law. She wants to redeem the land. She's really thinking about her own happiness a lot less than she's thinking about Naomi's happiness, right? Otherwise, she would have just gotten married, found a guy, and been settled down in Bethlehem to a good life. And then third, you see Boaz responding with incredible generosity and integrity in a moment of real darkness and confusion. What's happening here? And his sacrifice is offering himself, his possessions, and his connections to the town authorities to help those in need. Ruth and Naomi really could have been someone else's problem to deal with. That's kind of what he admits, even as he's confronted with this land and marriage proposal. But he steps in anyways and says, let me see if I can help out. Let me work through the proper channels and give this closer relative the right of first refusal. That's self-sacrificing loving kindness. We see it in all three characters. So, as we tie it together, God's achieving his plans through the actions of faithful people, and yet we don't always get it right. We don't even always perceive what's happening, do we? And that's okay, because God can always make a way, even in the failure of our own human plans, to accomplish his purposes. That's the story that's really woven through all of the Bible, isn't it? That God finds a way to make a way for us. And that's the story of redemption. When we talk about Jesus being our Redeemer, he redeems everything that we bumble around in the dark to try to accomplish. He redeems and accomplishes what we can't accomplish on our own. He fulfills what we start but can't finish. He completes the things that we would taint and ruin otherwise. There's a final verse in this chapter, verse 13, when Naomi says, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens. For the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. Isn't that like much of life? Waiting to find out how it all ends. Waiting for the test results to come back. Waiting to hear about school placements. Waiting to know what's the future of what's happening here in my community, here in my church. And as a planner, everything in me just wants to push against this. I want to know the details. I want to know how it's all going to end up. I want to know exactly how it's all going to fall into place. And yet, Ruth teaches us, God is faithful. We can trust a good God who has better plans than we do. His plans are good. Now, you might say, okay, if God's in meticulous control of everything, why bother doing anything? But that's not how God works. You take a step of faith. You enact these plans, just as Naomi did, as Ruth did. Stepping out in faith, taking steps, and saying, God, I don't see the end of this, but I trust you. And guiding us with loving kindness. So sometimes we're asked to simply wait until we find out what happens. See, I believe that God is at work even when the stage is darkened, where we can't see what's happening. We can't see all the details and we don't know how it'll end. We know God is faithful. Why would God choose to do it this way? I mean, why would God choose to do any of this in this story? Why feed Naomi in this way? Why provide Ruth a second husband in this way? Why preserve the family line of Elimelech through the birth of a son using a refugee? Why do that? I think the answer is this. It's to allow Hesed, God's loving kindness, to flourish and to bring us humans into the action. We get to be a part of this. Why? Because it brings God glory. It brings God glory to use us in our futile plans, which he can redeem at great cost. So next week, we'll get into chapter 4, which is set in the town of Bethlehem. The sun will rise. It won't be as dark. We'll be able to see more of God's details by daylight. But for now, and especially in this season of Advent, which is a season of hopeful waiting, we, like Ruth and Boaz and Naomi, are sometimes called to just lay there in the darkness and wonder, what happens next? But we can do that because we trust a good God with good plans who is faithful to his redemptive work all through history. You know, it kind of reminds me of another dark starry night in this very same town. Only this time it's to maybe shepherds stationed on the hillsides, not far from the threshing room floor of this story, where a quiet but mighty work of God might have actually gone unnoticed. Under the covering of darkness, unobtrusive, detected, really undetected by Bethlehem's sleeping residents, there was another miracle of God's plans and provision taking place. See, sometimes we fail to see it, but God is at work, born in the midst, in this case, into human flesh, right in the very messy middle of our darkest of nights. But alas, we will get to that story in the weeks to come. Let me pray for us. God, you are good and your plans are good. And we place ourselves under your refuge. And we know that all of our activity, we want to be guided by loving kindness and faithfulness to who you are and who you've called us to be. But we need redemption. We need your plan to complete and to fulfill and to accomplish what we cannot. And so we place ourselves under that redemption yet again, in faith, knowing that you are good where we fail to be good. And we thank you for your son, Jesus, who accomplishes all of this through his death and resurrection on the cross. Amen.